Tata Mutual Fund presents Wealth Architects in association with Money Control.
Hello, I'm Surabhi Upadhyay. Welcome to Wealth Architects, an exclusive podcast series presented by Tata Mutual Fund in association with Money Control. This series records the ideas, strategies, and structural shifts shaping the future of wealth management in India. The theme of today's episode is the new investment playbook. Now, for decades, the wealth creation playbook for Indian investors was relatively straightforward: equities, fixed income, gold, and real estate. But the investment universe today has expanded dramatically. Affluent investors now have access to everything from private equity and private credit to global markets, AIFs, REITs, InVITs, and a growing range of specialized investment solutions. The challenge today is not how to access this expanded universe, but understanding how to use the right tools at the right time and use these new investment opportunities strategically for long-term wealth creation. To talk in depth about this theme, joining us today is Saurabh Roongta, Deputy CEO and CIO at Centrum Wealth. Over the past two decades, Saurabh has advised sophisticated investors, family offices, and entrepreneurs across multiple market cycles. He brings a unique perspective on how investment opportunities and investor behavior are evolving. Saurabh, welcome to this conversation. So glad you're here with us today.
Thanks a lot, Surabhi, for giving me this opportunity.
So, Saurabh, as you heard in that introduction, slightly long one, but I think it's important to set the context, right? Things are changing, and perhaps faster than ever before, when it comes to wealth management.
Very clearly.
And you've been doing this for well over two decades.
Yes.
So let's start right there. Tell us a little bit about your journey.
In fact, when you were reading it out, I was just wondering, when I had started my career, it's pretty easy for me to calculate the number of years. I started my working career with this century, so it's 26 years and counting now. And when I had started with Citi, in the very first week, there were Citi Service Awards. And there was a category which started with 5 years, then 10 years, then 15 years. At 20, I thought this would be the last one, but the category ended up till 35 years. And I was there sitting, scratching my head, who works for 30, 35 years? And that also in a single organization. Mm. And today I am sitting here after having completed 26 years and having the energy for, I guess, another 26. So the journey has been very exciting. I started with the financial services industry, thanks to my family. Around 2010 is when I took the bold call of moving from the banking and the asset management industry to the wealth management industry. Mm-hmm. I thought that's the most evolving space. That's where we are going to see massive numbers of UHNIs, HNIs, family offices emerging in India. And I have been proven right.
So 26 years and counting, a lot has changed, I'm guessing, right? In terms of wealth, investors themselves, how they look at their wealth, and the marketplace. It has completely exploded with the number of options. So what would you say are the most dramatic shifts that you've witnessed in these last 26 years?
Oh, there have been many. I guess if I start, I still remember in 2010, 11, 12, we used to celebrate a four-digit, and I ignore the first seven digits of a crore in the combination or in the calculation. So we used to celebrate 1,000 crore clientele getting into our offices and that kind of a wealth coming into our books. Today, that number has already gone to five digits kind of a thing. So a 10,000 or 20,000 crore wealth family are existing in India. Mm-hmm. And the number goes into six digits also, lakhs of crores. So one, the wealth has really exploded with individual families. Mm. The second important thing is, I guess, the industry is growing faster than the talent pool. Okay. So the number of UHNIs, HNIs, family offices that we are seeing today, we don't have enough talent yet in our industry. And that's why you see a lot of ringa-ringa roses going around within our community. So people are jumping every 2 years, 3 years from one organization to another and so on and so forth. The third important piece that has changed according to me is the depth of the conversations. At the start of this century, the conversations were more concentrated towards what product, what return, and what horizon. Risk was never a part of the entire conversation. Mm-hmm. Today, risk has started getting part of the conversation. clients are more interested, besides products, into various other behavioral aspects. How do we manage wealth? What should be our investment policy statements? They are becoming more institutional-like in managing their wealth.
Okay.
And that's why I say today, in 2010, I guess, every wealthy family, when they would meet us, they would ask us, what's the next new business idea that we can look at? As against that, in today's backdrop, majority of the families are asking us, how do we set up a family office? How do we be in the business of managing money and not really looking at new business ideas? Mm. So various changes have taken place.
You know, this family office, this word didn't exist, at least when I started my career, which is also, exactly, you know, 20 plus years ago. And now you hear more and more of it. So just explain to our viewers, what is this beast? And is it above a certain wealth threshold that families think of the need of setting up an office? What goes into a family office? Just explain it to us.
It's a very interesting anecdote that I have. You know, in 2010, in fact, the word family office did not exist. Okay, we had only introduced into the industry the concept of advisory and saying that we are non-conflicted and we are sitting on the side of the table of the client while evaluating opportunities. Mm. It was in 2012-13 when the first of the pharma guys had landed up selling their businesses for that fabulous four-digit number. And that's when we were scratching our heads and trying to figure out what's the new proposition that we need to be giving to this gentleman. And that's when we came up this term family office. We borrowed it from the Western world. For us in 2011-12, family office basically meant replacing the traditional munim of the investor or the wealth owner, that we will consolidate your wealth, we'll give you one holistic view, we will become your bookkeepers, and we will consolidate all your assets, which is otherwise spread across multiple ledgers, multiple books, with multiple people. And it's not very surprising, people tend to forget where their wealth is parked. So family office started with that. However, today it has really caught up the nine yards with the Western world. Today, a family office starts with, how is it that you want to look at your wealth? It starts with a very behavioral answer. What do you want to achieve with your wealth? How do you want to preserve it for your generations? Then it comes to the structural aspect. Given the complex tax structure that we are living in for both investing in India as well as investing outside India, what kind of a structure is the most optimum structure that will help you manage your wealth in the most tax-efficient way? Then comes the investment policy statement, that after having decided what you want to achieve with your wealth, you actually lay down the do's and the don'ts. Okay, the rules get laid down. Then you create a full-fledged investment charter or an investment council, which will take care of each and every decision that you're taking and which will review the decisions after they have been made. So it's a full-fledged institutional framework of managing money. So family office today, if I have to call it out, is the business of managing money.
Sure. And is it generally you're seeing a family set this up above a certain threshold? And what is that threshold then?
So actually, the term family office does not have a standard definition. And that's why we were discussing what family office means. So the format in which a family office exists is also not a standard format. For an entrepreneur, with a wealth creation having happened, a family office can mean actually only one individual who's scanning all the investment opportunities and giving him an update before the wealth owner is actually taking a call. So that can be the simplest format of a family office. Okay, one single individual. Maybe backed up by one more individual to do the backup, back accounting and
the
all the
data
office
work.
On the other hand, you can have a full-fledged family office where the wealth owner is no longer the decision maker. He's created a team of professionals, and that professionals are actually managing the wealth completely independent. So it depends upon what is the cost that you're going to be incurring for your family office. Is what decides at what wealth you need to be looking at family office.
It's opinion also where the information comes in. Sometimes it's more than information, it's noise, lots and lots of noise. So what is the relevant, actionable information on which we have to really take a call? It becomes very tough. It's like finding a needle in a haystack. That's how the...
Bang on. And that's where my analytics, 90% of the data that we receive or the noise that we get has to be ignored. Of the remaining 10%, while you study it, 90% does not require any action. Only 1% of the total data points that we will receive in a year requires an action. And quite a few times, it does not require an immediate action. It actually requires you to slow down, let the activity play it out, because the volatility has increased.
Yeah, yeah.
After 3 days, things will come back to normal and you will realize there was no action required. And yeah, thank God you did not take any action.
Yeah. A little anecdote from my side as well, because I happen to speak to a lot of wealth managers and, you know, people who are advising from mass affluent to affluent. And this one particular manager was candid enough to tell me that since he did not act, he didn't feel the need to act or change anything in the portfolio. Ultimately, the client decided to pull off, saying, you know, nothing's happening. I'm not seeing a change. So what's the point? So I completely,
totally with you. And we are faced with that accusation almost every week.
Yeah.
So, if not every day.
So my sympathies are with all the advisors who are trying to sort of keep things stable and calm in a very, very difficult world and a very newsy and noisy world as well. Speaking of which, now let's address the news and the noise and the fact that product evolution has also really exploded, right?
Big time.
So as we discussed in the introduction, first, it was very simple. You have Indian equities, you have bonds, fixed income, you have obviously some real estate, so you have some precious metals and gold. That was it. That was your universe. Now, why don't you give us the outlines of this expanded universe? It's like the Big Bang and it's forever expanding, with more products and private markets and global investments, so much getting added to the mix. Just define the contours for us.
So you are bang on. I guess today, democratization of knowledge has happened,
mm-hmm,
and access is no longer a problem.
Mm-hmm.
So the decision making is actually about whether does it really help the portfolio of the client, whether does it really... It's two parameters that we always evaluate everything on. Does it really improve the return profile of the client, keeping the risk same, or does it really help us maintain the return but reduce the risk?
Mm-hmm.
That is how we have to evaluate. The traditional set always included mutual funds, then came PMSs, mm-hmm, then came AIFs, mm-hmm, now there are SIFs. So there are four different regulatory licenses to, mm-hmm, play the same thing, listed,
yeah,
equity.
Yeah.
Then came the debt world, where we, mm-hmm, merely had G-Secs, then came the corporate bonds, which were AAA. Today, mm-hmm, we have a AA series, we have A series, we, mm-hmm, have BBB series, mm-hmm, and unrated series.
Yeah.
Then we came to the private world.
Private markets,
the,
yeah,
private credits. Private credits have 10 to 12% performing credits, 12, mm-hmm, to 14 performing credits, 14 to 16 structured credits, 16 to 18 structured credits, 18 plus special situations, distressed assets.
Mm.
The entire scope is there.
Mm.
Then comes real estate, where we always had real estate as a physical asset being purchased by our clients. Then we got it in the format of funds, where you were taking equity bets on the real estate developers. Then came the debt world, where you were giving lending to real estate developers. Mm-hmm. So again, multiple sub-asset classes have got created within real estate. It's the newest addition being REITs and InvITs. And
Correct.
That's the most exciting thing right now. Mm-hmm. I guess it actually democratizes access to commercial real estate or the big properties into the hands of the retail clientele.
Mm-hmm.
Then we have the offshore, and the offshore arena is like 10 mm. times more bigger than the Indian opportunities.
Mm.
You have all kinds of asset classes available there. In fact, there are themes which are not even available in India, like hyperscalers, AI, robotics, semiconductors, chips. So there's a whole new world in offshore.
Yeah.
So the opportunities have really expanded. And as I said, the vector has to be return versus risk.
Sure.
Why are you adding it? Is,
yeah,
it a me-too product that you're adding it and you're merely increasing the line items in the portfolio? Or is it really serving some purpose?
Mm-hmm.
That's the most important thing that we need to figure out.
Yeah, absolutely. Are the returns able to justify the higher level of complexity when it comes to AIFs? And do you think SIFs will be able to then, you know, justify the fact that you are taking on a little bit of more additional risk and definitely more complexity on board?
So two parts to the question. Are the returns, mm-hmm, justifying it? It depends upon which time horizon you look at, you know. Numbers have a beauty, they can hide more than what they can reveal.
Mm.
So it depends upon the time period, the lens with which you are evaluating the numbers. I can always show you a time period when a particular mutual fund is doing bad, and that same mutual fund on a different time lens may be doing good,
sure,
and on a third lens may be doing,
mm-hmm,
the best.
Mm-hmm.
So it depends upon the lens with which you are looking at. We nowadays recommend our advisors don't look at a point-to-point return,
yeah,
analysis,
yeah,
look,
yeah,
at a rolling,
returns, yeah, yeah,
three-year rolling, mm-hmm, return analysis. You are anyways getting into the asset class for a longer time horizon. So rolling period analysis gives you the most data and analytical points to look at. Coming to the second aspect, yes, with AIFs and SIFs, in one way we can look at risks have increased. exposures are now being taken in derivatives, and you're not taking exposures only for the long only, you're also taking exposures on the short side.
Correct.
But actually, if the entire framework is stitched very well, then it reduces the risk for the client's portfolio. Mm-hmm. It does not enhance the risk. It helps you ensure that even in a falling market, you are pretty cushioned and you don't experience the full downside is not captured into your portfolio.
Mm-hmm.
So the risks have, from the gross aspect, the risks have increased, but they net off each other and the net risk that we are giving to our investors has reduced.
Okay. So you sound fairly, optimistic on SIFs. AIFs, alternates, what is that universe looking like and how has it evolved, say, post-COVID? And what's your take on it?
Alternatives as an asset class has really gone through the roof. But I guess, having said that, we are still taking baby steps. Mm. If you look at the developed world, the private equity markets, I'm not even counting the credit market, the private equity market is today approximately 20% of the listed equity market. In India, our listed equity market, I guess with the last 3 days of positive greens that we are seeing, would have touched $5 trillion again. Is the private credit plus equity market at $1 trillion, 20%? Is it at $800 billion? No way. It's a far cry away.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, it has exploded, but it has not yet got democratized. It is not yet being evaluated with every HNI which is there on the street. It is still a UHNI family office club. Private markets make a lot of sense. It is actually complementary to listed markets. Because of one key change that has taken place in Indian entrepreneurial organizations, which is in 90s, Indian entrepreneurs used to get themselves listed early.
Mm.
You used to see a lot of 500,000 crore listings. Today, most of the good companies, the entrepreneurs are not getting their companies listed early. They are actually waiting for the companies to become unicorns and multi-unicorns, $10 billion, $20 billion size before they come and hit the market.
Mm.
So private markets is a very important asset class. If you want to participate in the growth story of some of these beautifully compounding companies, you will have to access them in private markets.
Mm-hmm.
Same is the case with private credits. With the tax arbitrage being taken away from the mutual fund debt industry, I guess fixed income was actually becoming a dead asset class for the UHNIs and the family offices. The advent of private credit has been a fresh lease of life for fixed income portfolios. And today we are seeing good amount of participation in this asset class.
But what about regulation? Has regulation evolved and has it managed to keep pace with the private market? Listed markets, absolutely. Like you said, it's, transparent as clear glass, costs are low, you can compare returns. But on the private side, things are still fairly opaque. So how do we compare in terms of just the regulatory evolution vis-a-vis developed markets, say the US?
I often say sometimes ignorance is bliss. Regulators in India have done a fabulous job.
Mm.
They have cushioned us from a lot of volatility that is taking place in the outside world. It has also not allowed us to do that much amount of innovative structuring that is happening outside India.
Yeah.
But are we there ready for it is also a very important question. So according to me, regulators are doing a fabulous job.
Mm-hmm.
We will continue to see some blow up here or there in some industry or some company.
Mm.
But is that only restricted to India, Surabhi? Have we not seen the Madoffs of the world in the Western worlds? And
the sizes
were so big that India couldn't have even afforded that kind of a size blowing up in So according to me, regulators are doing a fabulous job. They are, with passage of time, introducing more regulations, giving us more liberty and laying down the control parameters.
Mm-hmm.
And with those strong control parameters, I guess the acceptance and the democratization of these products will only improve.
Private markets are something to watch out for in the coming years as they evolve here in India. Now I want to come to the big question, and that is AI.
Yeah.
How can we not talk about it? Because I don't think the investment thesis for India was ever challenged as much as it's being challenged today. We're so used to being the toast of town. We were always used to being the best market, in the room in the world. So how are you thinking about this, Saurabh? And the question is whether this is a flavor, 1-2 years flavors last and they come and they go, or whether it is far more structural than that. And then therefore, it'll need a thought accordingly.
So actually, again, it's a combination of 2 to 3 questions. I will try to answer each of them. So is AI talk of the town a mere wave? Will it pass away or is it a structural thing? according to me, it's a structural thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's a new tool that we have created, and it's going to change the way we have lived life.
Mm-hmm.
It's something as transformational as we inventing electricity, we inventing cars and automobile, we inventing internet. So it's in that league.
Mm.
So yes, definitely AI is going to be there. It's going to stay and it's going to change the life. The behavioral way of interpreting today or how markets are interpreting today is India is anti-AI. India does not have any AI play. But actually, I will just ask you, did India invent electricity? Did India invent internet? Did India invent the first cell phone? But we were the adopters of it.
Mm.
We adopted it, we embraced it, and we flourished with it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we are missing.
Mm.
You know, Indians have always been known for what we call colloquially, jugaad. We always knew, someone in this 150 crore, always knew how to solve that same problem in lesser time, with lesser resources,
mm-hmm.
in a most cost-efficient way.
Mm.
But they never had the tool of making that idea converted into an actual practical product or an example for the world to see.
Mm.
AI will actually be that tool for every Indian mind,
sure.
which has that jugaad, which has that thought to convert it into an actual life product.
So I don't have a doubt on that, on our jugaad ability. But from an investing perspective, if we go back to 2000, to Y2K, it took a complete burst of the bubble, a total crash for the investing world to move on beyond, you know, IT and tech and .com. And for the great Indian bull market to be born, which was around the time that I think I started tracking the markets, 2004-05, right? So we needed a big crash of the bubble to burst for the world to say, acha, let's do something else. But I don't know, I mean, we probably, how far away are we from that now? Because right now the world is obsessed with these AI hyperscalers and we don't have them.
This theme is actually ruling the roost, I guess. Unfortunately, not an oracle. I can't make that prophecy. But reality is every transformational change needs a massive investment at the infrastructure level.
Mm.
And if this bubble is not formed, that infrastructure investment will not happen.
Mm.
If that infrastructure investment does not happen, the adoption and democratization will not happen. So are you seeing it? It's a vicious circle. It is a necessary evil that has to take place for it to change the lives and make that transformational meaning for all of us.
Like the internet did, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. So we need those trillions of dollars to be going into the infrastructure and getting that basic infrastructure placed for everyone. Anything which is not going to get democratized, anything which is going to get restricted to fewer hands will never change materially anything on the grounds.
Yeah, true.
So this is a necessary thing. I guess a couple of weeks back, we have started seeing some amount of slowdown in the growth of the revenue numbers for some of these hyperscalers that we are watching out for. Will it result into a full-fledged blow-up of the bubble? Will it result into mere slowdown? It's for to be seen in times to come.
Mm-hmm.
But AI is there. It's real.
Okay. So since it's here and for now, nothing is changing. In terms of the investment thesis, diversifying away from Indian shores, I guess that becomes important. So what are you telling clients on this now?
I guess the LRS regulations, if I remember correctly, came out in 2004. At that point in time, it gave a limit of $25,000 per person per financial year. Today, it is at $250,000, 10 times. And today, I can assure you the number of families saying that $250,000 is not adequate is running into million plus. So offshore investing has become a real thing. How I really tackle for my families is I actually ask them, it's not about the product, it's not about the geography. It is more about where are you going to consume, where are you going to live, where are you going to retire? That is the basic starting point. If the family is looking at living their life outside India, then the portfolio has to be structured outside India. Yeah. It has to get created and it has to get deployed outside India.
Mm-hmm.
And Indian allocation has to be more like the tactical allocation, which is really helping them either enhance their returns or diversify their risk. On the opposite side, if the family is very clear they're going to be based out of India, then we are saying that today, anywhere between 15 to 25% of your portfolio has to be based outside India.
Okay.
You have to be sending money outside the LRS route, OPI route, or the ODI routes, the regulations that the government and the regulators have created.
Mm-hmm.
There are themes, as I said earlier, which are not available in India, which we will need to play. India is not the only emerging market. If you read the 2075 Goldman report, where they have tried to visualize how the world will look like in 2075, Indonesia is supposed to become the fourth or the fifth largest economy. So there are enough amount of these emerging economies available where we would want to participate. In India, the base has already grown. Mm-hmm. We have grown from a $1 trillion to $5 trillion over the course of this last 15, 20 years. Compounding at $5 trillion is going to be that much more difficult. Compounding at a smaller base of $2-3 trillion, for some of the Southeast Asian countries will be much more easier.
Sure.
So we Indians need to diversify, need to invest outside. And obviously then there is the INR play. We cannot invest everything in INR. INR will continue to depreciate. It's economics. It's no sentiments which are playing out.
Yeah.
Sentiments can only
exacerbate or enhance the
depreciation, but it is there for us to
do. Okay, so plenty of food for thought there. Very clear. Look out for private markets. Look out for what's happening with respect to global investing, especially if you have any intention of having a part of your life outside India. So with those thoughts and a lot of important wisdom nuggets, I want to come to final thoughts. Anyone who's watching this and who's thinking about their wealth, when they sit down to talk to their wealth manager maybe, or if they're a DIY individual, what are the lessons? What are the two or three things that they should keep in mind? And also touch upon the behavioral aspects. So both in terms of just product knowledge, markets, what to look at, and just in terms of investing psyche.
So I guess from the structural perspective, what I will say is before you start investing, take a step back and actually decide what do you want to achieve? Mm. What is the kind of return are you ready to live with? Sometimes the more important question is what is the kind of risk that will allow you to have a peaceful sleep? Today we have prices available for everything on a ticker by ticker basis, second by second basis. And the human biasness will force us to go and keep on checking our valuation every now and then. And the MTM losses and the swings will give us a lot of heartache. So what level of heartache will not disrupt your peaceful sleep in the night is the most important question, which behaviorally every investor needs to triangulate, calibrate before they take steps on investing side. Mm. The other important piece is, which I will say, put a big stabilizer beneath your heart, guys. The volatility is here to stay. It's only going to be more volatile in times to come because we are getting access to so much amount of information. And with every information, there will be a tendency to act and then regret and then come back. So volatility is there. Put a big stabilizer beneath. And the third thing I will say is get into the deeper layers of information. Okay. What is it that will cause the risk? What is it that will help you achieve the return that is being projected? And once you are able to identify and get your gut behind it, then have the right sizing of investment in that particular idea, in that particular product. A 0.5% investment will not move the cheese, even if that product has given you 500% return. Sure. So right sizing of your bets is the most important thing.
Identify the bets and then play them big.
Play them big.
All right, Saurabh, great conversation. Lots and lots of insights there and plenty of food for thought, like I said. Fantastic to have you on the show today. Thanks for joining in.
Thank you.
Well, there you go. Plenty of insightful messages there coming through. What really stands out is that the modern portfolio is no longer just about chasing returns. It has to be looking at building resilient, efficient, and adaptable strategies that can navigate all the uncertainty and the volatility that Saurabh spoke about. Well, thank you for joining us on The Wealth Architects on this conversation today. Stay tuned. We'll be back with many more.
Mutual fund investments are subject to market risks. Read all scheme-related documents carefully. Tata Mutual Fund presents Wealth Architects in association with Money Control.